Hello and welcome again to Monster Island Radio. I'm Ben, and as always, I'm joined by the ever energetic
Graham.
Hello. Okay, so today we're talking about Rodan. We're covering his debut 1956 film today. So, unsurprisingly, the team behind this are mostly the usual suspects. We've got directed by Ishiro Honda, visual effects director is Eiji Tsuburaya, music by Akira Ifukube again, but this time the story is written by Ken Kuronuma, and then the screenplay is by Ken Kuronuma, Takeshi Kimura, and Takeo Murata. So yeah, slightly different setup there, but most of the same people. So let's do a quickish summary. This one's not too bad, actually. I managed to get this one down fairly short.
No, and some things do happen.
Yeah, they do.
So that's good.
It's good. Okay, so two miners, Goro and Yoshi, go missing during a flood in the mines in the village of Kitamatsu at the foothills of Mount Aso. Yoshi is found dead by engineer Shigeru Kawamura. Due to the cuts Yoshi suffered, the villagers believe Goro had actually killed him and fled the scene, as the two were known for hating each other. Shigeru visits his fiancée, Kyo, to console her as she's shouldering the blame for her brother Goro's supposed actions. But before long, a large creature appears and bursts through her home. The creature kills two police officers in its rampage and escapes to the mines. Everyone chases the creature and in the process discover Goro's dead body in the mine. Shigeru uses a minecart to kill the creature, but then another one appears, and as they're shooting it, it causes a cave-in, trapping Shigeru. Paleontologist Dr. Kashiwagi determines that the creature is a Meganulon, an ancient dragonfly larva from 200 million years ago. The police go to investigate the damage from a recent earthquake and discover Shigeru wandering around the epicenter. They bring him into a hospital and find that he's suffering from amnesia. Meanwhile, there are reports from several nations across Asia that there's a supersonic UFO flying around, causing havoc, ruining buildings, killing people and livestock. Kashiwagi suspects that it could be a pteranodon, dubbed Rodan, that's responsible. Shigeru's memory is triggered by the sight of bird eggs hatching and recalls seeing Rodan hatching from a colossal egg feasting on the Meganulons. Rodan re-emerges, flies to Fukuoka and destroys the city. Just as we think things couldn't get worse, a second Rodan appears. Amongst the rubble, a plan is put in place by the military to bomb Mount Aso, where the Rodans have been holding up, to bury them. Kitamatsu is then evacuated for the plan to be put in action, as the attacks could trigger an eruption. The missiles are fired, but it ends up triggering an eruption and also flushes out the Rodans. One of the Rodans suffers an injury in the eruption and collapses in the flames, and the remaining Rodan tries to save the other, but ultimately pays the price in doing so and dies amongst the flames. So, bye-bye, Rodans. So, yes, that was that. So, I sound down on it, but I'm not. So, as you mentioned to me before we started recording, we've got a couple of corrections to make from our previous episodes. So, do you want to go first?
No, you go first. I think yours is more important. Mine's more silly.
Okay, right. So, yeah, I said during Mothra 1961 episode that it was the first Toho color movie. Which was a lie. I was clearly wrong because this one came out in 1956 and it was in colour. So yeah, that's on me. I don't know why I thought that, but yeah, I got it totally wrong. So just ignore that bit.
You can kind of see as well, like a lot of early colour movies, when they do the opening titles of this film, it's all like just colours like flashing at you.
Yeah, yeah.
When all the names and stuff are coming up and it's like, oh yeah, like this is obviously like, you know, we've got the colour, guys.
So it's
psychedelic. Like,
yeah, so with 3D movies, everything's coming at the camera kind of thing. Yeah.
So my correction was, in the last episode we did, I joked that we would be revisiting Magic Juice again in Rodan. And I don't know, I must have got my wires crossed about that because I hadn't seen Rodan before, but I had heard or thought I heard that it had magic beans or magic juice or whatever it is. And this is not a magic berry kind of movie.
No.
So maybe I got my wires crossed and there's more magic berries coming down the road, but this was not a magic berry adventure.
I was sitting
which
there.
I was kind of waiting for it.
I was waiting. I was waiting for the berries, but
Right until the very end, I was like, at some point it's going to be magic berries and they're going to, like, you know, stop Rodan using magic berries or something.
It's going to eat from a magic berry bush and die.
Yeah, it didn't hinder my enjoyment of the movie, though. Yeah, and obviously it was a refreshing change from magic berries, as it turns out.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I quite enjoyed this one.
I was stepping on the rest of the podcast a little bit, but I absolutely loved this. I really, really enjoyed it. I remember when we were teenagers, you were like quite a Rodan fan of the, you know, fan of the character.
It's from the game.
From the game. So
playing, you know, Godzilla, what's it called? I've got to look at it again. Godzilla Destroy All Monsters Melee on the GameCube. You want to play as Rodan because you're in the air and you can just fire, you know, it's a bit OP. You know, you can just sort of attack everybody who's on the ground and they can't really get you.
Mm.
And if I'm not mistaken, Mothra is not in that first one. There is a sequel to.
She's like, what's it called?
Oh, it's like an assist or something, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the one.
You call her in, you can't control her.
Yeah, and she does little beams.
Yeah, there's a Godzilla fighting game on the Wii, which is a sequel, and it's got like way, way more characters, and I think you can play as her in that one. But yeah, that's why I liked Rodan, because I would always play as Rodan in that, and especially in the story mode, you just like wipe through it.
Yeah.
But I also love the cry. I think Rodan's like monster roar is probably the best one, in my opinion.
It is a good
one. It's really good.
Yeah.
So yeah, I do like Rodan.
So did the movie live up to your expectations?
It's not without its faults, but I think it's more to do with age. I mean, the previous episode to this, we did Mothra versus Godzilla. Fun movie, but you know, it was creaky. It lacked some charisma, ultimately.
Mm.
And this one, it's a bit older. It's nearly, it's like
5 years older. Yes, you're right. Yeah, 8 years. Yeah.
Mm. And I mean, it's quite impressive. Like with Godzilla 54 and Mothra and Rodan, I think they are they're notably higher in quality than the movies that follow on, where it becomes about like the verses and like contriving like a new reason for like monsters like Godzilla to come back and all of that. And I'd say, yeah, this was more in line with Godzilla and Mothra in terms of like feeling like a real movie, if you like.
Yes.
And not just like, oh, we need to, you know, get a tentpole film out for a bit of money.
Yeah.
Because we see like Ishiro Honda directs all of these, but from his filmography, he's just sort of like a jobbing director at Toho, I guess. And I'm not sure how.
I think a lot of the staff are.
Yeah. And it's like, were these movies, the kaiju movies, made just sort of like out of obligation? I'm not really sure about his history. I'd like to look into that more for myself and see, like, well, how much did he really enjoy doing these monster sequels? But at least for these, what you could call origin movies, the attention to detail is a lot more apparent and is a better made movie in terms of, like, story, effects, tension, editing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it did sort of, like, you know, it's a proper introduction to this character. I don't know how much we'll get out of Rodan in the future installments, because I've seen the next movie in the Showa series where he turns up along Ghidorah and all that. But as far as like what is Rodan's sort of future like in the Showa era of Godzilla, I don't actually know.
Yeah.
So hopefully it does sort of continue this quality, but remains to be seen for me.
Yeah, that's a good point, because it did make me question, like when you say about like Godzilla 1954, Mothra's original movie and this one, it made me think, well, these are always like very good compared to the rest. And I was like, does that mean I'm not so big on the other ones, like the Versus movies and stuff like that? And it really made me question what it is I actually enjoy about these, which I found quite strange, actually. But I don't think that's true. I don't think, because I mean, I still love Giant Monsters All Out Attack, you know, one of the Millennium movies.
Yeah.
That's, you know, that's a big Versus movie, and that's still, you know, one of my absolute faves. So I don't think it's means I'm not a fan of those kinds of movies.
No, it's not a broad thing as such.
No. But yeah, you're right. There's a notable quality, a difference in quality between, the original movies and then what comes after, I think, especially in the Showa era.
Yeah, on paper, I want the Versus movie, but in practice, from the Showa era specifically, the individual ones have been stronger. I think we could dig into this topic of like which ones are better as individuals, which ones are better as Versus, you know, but they're often very different kinds of things, of a different vibe. And naturally, any movie with like Versus in the title becomes more popcorn-y. I guess you see this all the way through, actually. Like, the 2014 Godzilla, obviously, they hadn't really found their footing with what they wanted to do with MonsterVerse, but they go quite serious with that.
Yep.
And then by the time you get to Godzilla vs. Kong, it's like a completely different kind of action movie. So the same pattern is sort of there, regardless of whether or not the solo outing is successful or not. By the time you get to the head-to-head movie, it's more kind of like silly just by nature.
Yeah, I suppose you kind of have to start out quite serious, I think, in order for people to take the characters seriously.
I guess so.
You know, to really kind of get behind the character or the monster or whatever.
I would still take what they were trying to do with Gareth Edwards' 2014 movie just done better. I think it's a good attempt. And I don't mind a serious Godzilla at all, because obviously we talk about 54 and blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think it's too po-faced. I think we covered this in the episode. It doesn't have enough fun.
Yeah.
And it detracts away from action too much and all that. But, you know, all I'm saying is, like, it's not universal that the solo movie is better. It's just that we are kind of picking up on the tonal differences that is implied. Because the versus movies are just by nature, like, that's what you're gunning towards. Regardless of what the story is, it's always just about that. And that's often what they trip over or what we kind of get impatient about. So, yeah, it's just something that's becoming more apparent, I guess.
Yeah. So yeah, this movie is a bit of a fusion genre movie, I thought, because it starts out as kind of like a murder mystery with, like, you know, Yoshi getting killed and then Gara's disappeared, and then, you know, it causes some upheaval in the town, and you know, because Gara's wrongly accused and all that stuff, and then it kind of takes a sharp turn into like a sci-fi horror movie when the Mega Nulon appears in her house in Kyo's house. Kind of like, you know, kind of like the Blob kind of thing, you know, that kind of 50s sci-fi horror thing. That actually startled me when the Mega Nulon showed up.
I liked the Mega Nulon in this movie, but I still didn't like the sound they were making. It, to me, it wasn't like menacing enough. It was just sort of like, they make this sort of squeaky sort of sound, and it doesn't really, to me, I don't know what you think from like a sound design point of view, but it doesn't really feel like they're making that sound. It's just like, that is the sound that the movie wants to associate with their presence.
Absolutely. I think maybe it was so it could differentiate it from Rodan, probably. And it's like, we'll have something that sounds a bit more kind of, I suppose it sounds synthetic, but that kind of cosmic-y, sci-fi, sort of lasery sound, whatever the hell it is. It's so distinct. But I completely agree with what you're saying, because it's like, yeah, it just feels like, oh, they've played that sound. This means there's a Mega Nulon about.
Yeah.
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 But yeah. But yeah, their appearance, like, it reminded me of how, like, the only bits of Godzilla versus Megaguirus that we praised were those kind of street-level moments with the Mega Nulons.
Yeah, like, I couldn't help but think back to that. But also how that I wanted it to be more horror.
It could have had some more, actually.
Mm.
And then it turned into the kaiju tokusatsu kind of movie.
I mean, the structure of this is quite interesting, actually, because the start of the movie, like you said, being kind of like you could look at it as a mixture of genres, but the first half hour is very much dedicated to the Mega Nulon and like what's happening with the miners. Somebody's dead. We reveal the Mega Nulon, and that's the problem. And then eventually, we just take a big break from the Mega Nulon, and it starts being about Rodan. And until Rodan appears, we don't go back to the Mega Nulon again. And it's like almost like the first 2-30 minutes is like, you know, two different things, and it doesn't kind of overlap, and they don't edit them together. And the way that it builds up to this thing that, like, oh, you think the Mega Nulon are the menace of the movie, but ultimately they turn out to merely be the food of this bigger creature. Mm-hmm. So you can't really intermingle them as stories. But when you're watching it, it's very odd that you sit through what is effectively one episode, and then the second episode within the movie doesn't really talk about Mega Nulon that much.
It's interesting, because that's what I liked about it. I thought that worked in its favor, because that's exactly what I thought as well. It's like, oh, you think these are the threat. These Mega Nulons are the scary thing. Oh, and there's more than one of them. Oh, my God. And then it turns out to be food for an even bigger threat. I was like, oh, like, that'd be so great, I think, not knowing what's going on going in. I mean, the trouble is with this era of movie making and advertising is, you know, you've got posters that say Rodan, the flying creature, whatever, you know. The flying monster. And, like, you got a picture of it, and you're, like, going in, you'd know. And, like, especially trailers back then, they basically show you the whole movie.
Yeah.
So it's like you would never go in and be surprised by anything that's happened, which is really bizarre, and I don't like that about... I mean, they do it in trailers now, but I would love to watch this not knowing what the hell is going to happen, because I imagine that works, that flow works really well. So yeah, you do kind of forget about the Meganulons after that point, but it's because something more pressing has reared its head.
Yeah, so, I think it's hard to put yourself in the minds of somebody who doesn't know what's going to happen there.
Well,
but I think because they do sort of bench the Meganulon to such a degree, it's hard not to predict yourself that they're no longer going to be the problem, because they go from being the focal point of the movie, and then there's like a 20 minute chunk where they don't really feature at all. So it feels like they need to keep the Meganulon threat going as they start to talk about Rodan, and they could have maybe built upon the murder mystery story a bit more, maybe like a couple more people in the town get offed or something, and it's like, oh well, it's the Meganulon, but we haven't quite like got to that point. So it's just sort of just overlap it a little bit so it doesn't feel like they're quite so absent.
Yeah, because they could have been like, oh, we need to evacuate the town because the Meganulons are still rampaging, kind of
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, they could have done something like that. And it's like, we want to keep the idea that the Meganulons are the problem, but they just sort of leave it entirely while they then go to talk about Rodan. And the Rodan stuff is interesting because this is a movie which really, they put a lot of effort into explaining the presence of the creature. You know, it's farcical, but they do, you know, cover it quite in detail. Mm. But yeah, it's just a shame that they do sort of, we're going to leave the Meganulon, and then they don't come back to them until they're sort of saying, well, now they're not an issue anymore, because that turns out they're just Rodan's meal. So just a little bit of overlapping would have just helped that transition feel like, oh, like the Meganulon are a menace and we really don't like them. And then suddenly, sort of thing, Rodan it appears, because it's almost like Rodan appears through being explained before he appears on screen, sort of thing. Through the way the film's structured, at least to me, that's how I felt. I felt like, oh, now we're into, like, we're talking about, you know, flying dinosaurs and stuff like that. You can feel it's coming before we even get to it, so they could have maybe concealed it a little bit more, perhaps. But
yeah, it was how they tried to kind of explain what was going on with Rodan before you saw him. It was kind of, I feel like they were trying to build up a whole UFO kind of vibe to it first. They were like, oh, we don't know what it could be. It could be a UFO, this thing from space.
Even though the movie's called Flying Monster, but it could be a UFO.
Yeah, so that's exactly what I mean. It's like, that sort of stuff just like it removes any of that mystery. So yeah, not knowing that would be great. But yeah, they did that sort of, yeah, maybe it's a UFO, maybe it's aliens kind of thing. And I really like that, actually. Yeah, and I thought that worked really well. And then you start to see glimpses of it and you're like, well, that doesn't quite look like a UFO. And then you see photos and then they figure out what it could be. And I liked that build up. I thought that was good. But yeah, I like the story idea. I like this idea of, you know, prehistoric dinosaurs waking up in a modern town, basically, and like their instincts kick in. They're roaming around looking for food and terrorize hapless humans. You know, I thought that was good. I mean, it's I suppose it's a foundation for stuff like Billy and the Clonosaurus. You know, so I thought that was great. I really enjoyed the story, and it actually employed some of the kind of narrative structures that you pointed out in Godzilla 1954 with the flashback and stuff like that, of like, you know, when
he gets his memory back.
Yeah, when he gets his memory back, you're like, oh, what was it he saw? Because like, I really love the idea of him losing his memory, not because of the cave-in, but because he saw something so terrifying it's like it just wiped his memory. I thought that was really cool. So yeah, seeing that flashback, seeing what it was, and seeing this huge thing eating the thing that was terrorizing the towns, I thought was a very cool reveal. But actually, no, I do see what you're saying now, actually, because you do kind of get the idea of Rodan before you see him come from the egg, don't you? Because, yeah, you do see him flying at one point. Yeah, I think I get what you mean, actually.
Yeah.
I think I get what you mean.
They could just tweak it a little bit to make it feel like there was more than one threat at once, I guess is how I would put it. Because it feels like we deal with one threat, and that threat of the Meganulon is very much still ongoing, but the movie just sort of forgets about it, where it's like, we could just overlap it a bit, just a little bit more. So it's like, oh, you know, you could even do a shot where like somebody was being attacked by Meganulon and then Rodan like flies over and they're like, oh, what? Something like that. But I think this is to do with age of the movie. And I think if we were seeing this same film made now, and obviously we have seen other kaiju things made, this sort of Rodan is all about the build-up to Rodan's appearance, Rodan's existence being explained, and then Rodan being dealt with. But that explanation and the reveal takes up most of the movie, and today that would just be the first half hour, and then we'd have another series of events. Back in the 50s, this was enough to fill a film and you'd be quite satisfied with it. And yeah, for its era, it is actually a really good movie. It's just, you know, you see its age and that, like, we're spending a lot of time on these little details, and, you know, satisfying as they may be, it just feels like they could have done more. And I don't know that, you know, people would have really felt like that back in the 1950s, or we just feel that way from, you know, this, looking back on it.
Yeah, actually, because it does have some, yeah, those kind of similarities with things like, well, Mothra, for example, where most of the interesting stuff is reserved for the last part. But I don't know. I feel like, I think pacing-wise, this is probably the best example of probably all the ones we've seen out of this Showa era for me, because of that build-up, the way it ups the ante each time with each thing. Like, you think, oh, it's one Meganulon, then there's multiple, then there's Rodan, and then, oh shit, there's two Rodans. And I felt like the pacing for each of those things just kind of, you know, hooked me the whole way through. And like, it wasn't particularly character focused, and I mean that in the best way possible. You know, what we have character wise you know, pushes the narrative and the mystery forward without becoming tiresome or uninteresting, and like, just keep, you know, those reveals kind of keep coming. So I think pacing wise this was like, this was bang on for me. But I don't know, is that how you feel or not?
I think it's not so much about pacing is what I mean. It's more that if this were a modern movie, they would, I mean, just by virtue of the kaiju genre progressing at this point in the early part of the genre, you know, it's only a couple of years since Godzilla came out, they would know that audiences will need to see a bit extra. The whole idea of the monster being revealed and then being dealt with, it wouldn't be enough. And we just see that as movies, you know, as movies become more modern, the more recent films just have more going on, you know, where they deal with more than one monster, or there's, you know, just events.
Oh, I see. So basically sort of more threads going on at once kind of thing.
Yeah, I feel like they could have maybe, I mean, not that they should change Rodan, because I think Rodan's a fine movie, but if it were modern, I think that they would get to Rodan a bit quicker and we would see more kind of going on once he was, you know, a present threat, rather than it just being like, it's pretty much once Rodan is out in the open, he has a bit of an action sequence in the one city and then they kind of get rid of him. And a lot of the action is, yeah, reserved for the end. Whereas even in Godzilla, there's a lot more like narrative around, oh, this thing exists, we need to get rid of this thing, and the movie is kind of about solving the problem, and the problem
while
solving,
the terror is going on,
yeah, takes up the like, more of the movie. Whereas in Rodan, it's more about building to the problem, and then the problem actually takes up less of the movie as a result.
I so get you.
They're different,
yeah,
but yeah, it's just that, you know, older movies just have less things happening in them in general. Not always the case, you know, something like Wizard of Oz, loads of things happen in it, and it's way older than this movie. But you see what I mean, is that, you know, as the monster movie genre progresses, we expect more. And I just feel that absence in this one in a way that I probably didn't so much in Godzilla and Mothra.
Oh, right. Okay.
But I still enjoyed it just as much, and it was just, you know, a bit different. Because, you know, they get the Meganulons in there, and, you know, they haven't... Once it's revealed that Rodan eats Meganulons, I guess we're just left to presume that, well, he's eaten all of them. You know, and they're gone. They never really resurface in the film. Not that they should necessarily, but it just feels like, well, the movie kind of does deal with one thing at a time. And it's very enjoyable. I don't want to be down on it at all. It's just that that's where you see the creakiness of like, well, if this was a modern film, it would feel a bit more multifaceted. After I watched it, I put on just that Rodan part from the recent King of the Monsters movie.
Yeah.
Just to see, like, well, what happened to Rodan? Like, you know, what's the modern one? And it just reminds me, like, well, that movie, King of the Monsters, for all of its flaws that we talked about in our first episode, is very multifaceted and lots of things are going on at once.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, how I would compare them from being, like, 70 years apart, basically. That Rodan part of King of the Monsters is easily the best chunk of the movie.
Absolutely, yeah.
I think when we first watched it, I was so invested in the film, and then when the climax comes, and I think it's pretty disappointing, the climax of the movie, that left me on like a sour note, and that's apparent in our episode. But anything in that film, from when Rodan comes out of the volcano to when Ghidorah lands back on top of the volcano, which is just one of the chapters on the Blu-ray, which you can just watch in isolation,
that's
the best part of the film.
So I
don't know what Rodan's going to be doing in the future Showa movies, but it's just a good character, like big pterodactyl, like let's have it sort of thing. But yeah, that's what I mean about this. With the older movie, the 56 Rodan movie, you just feel a kind of, not an emptiness at all, but things are left to breathe in a way that through just media literacy or progression of a genre, we don't need as much time spent on these things now. And that's the only real detractor of the film, is that, yeah, it's like 70 years old and it feels like it. But other than that, I really enjoyed it.
I think it probably plays in its favor to me, because like I think I've said to you before, like for some reason when I'm watching a movie, when I first watch it, I don't take all of it in, especially when there's a lot of stuff going on, because I find myself focusing on maybe the wrong parts of a movie. So it's not until the second viewing where I really fully get what's going on. Maybe I'm just dumb. But,
I don't think so. I think some films are designed that way, aren't they? There's multiple layers.
Yeah, probably. Let's say that.
Certainly new movies are like that, especially like, you know, since the advent of home media and stuff like that, it's all very different. Older movies are a bit more simple, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. So like for me watching this, I was like, even though I did watch it a few times, after the first time, you know, I totally got it. And I suppose there's a bit of pressure, because when we're doing one of these episodes, I want to make sure I don't miss anything. So that's why I end up watching things several times. But with this, yeah, it all kind of like all clicked into place absolutely fine for me. So I felt quite satisfied watching it. And I think maybe because we're doing this might be the reason. But yeah, it's I loved it. I loved it. Yeah, it had a bit more of a serious tone again, I suppose, like the other original movies. Well, Mothra wasn't that serious, but obviously Godzilla 54 was. They kind of touched on the whole hydrogen bomb testing as to why, the Meganulons and Rodan were reborn. Yeah. And they kind of hinted at global warming at one point, and I thought that was what they were. I thought that was going to be the driving point for the reason they all came back. And it really made me think, like, if they do ever do a reboot, I think that would be a great thing to revisit. Like having this idea of, you know, the global temperatures heating up these eggs, basically incubating the eggs in the water kind of thing. I was like, that would be because a lot of these films, you know, they kind of have a point to them. You know, obviously Godzilla, it's the atomic bomb, blah blah blah. So like having that idea of like, oh well, climate change, bringing back Rodan, that'd be a great movie, I think. And also, I really liked they only touched on it a little bit, but there was the their plan to kill the Rodans was, you know, bombing that that mountain, that volcano, and this idea of like, well, you know, if it causes an eruption, you know, it could, you know, there's like destruction of nature to stop further loss. Well, I thought it was quite an interesting conflict. You know, it's like, oh, should we go ahead with doing this? It's like, well, we don't really have much choice. I really liked that conflict there. I didn't really dwell on it that much, but I really liked the kernels of these ideas in there. What I thought were really good. I'd like to see that explored again. I don't think don't know how Rodan really pans out throughout the rest of the era, so we probably won't touch on any of these themes ever again. But I really liked them in this. So.
From what I can see, Rodan as a movie did not make that much money. Wasn't successful. In the same way Godzilla was?
Yeah, it was successful in the US. It had, quite a huge marketing campaign.
But maybe that explains why we didn't get, like, Rodan 2, 3, 4, the same way you got, like, Godzilla and so on. It doesn't feel like there is as much of a kind of dramatic kind of point to it in the same way Godzilla has as well.
Yeah.
It's like it means something when, like, this creature appears. And I do like Rodan's death. It's like, oh, we have to kill them, and that kind of quandary is definitely there, like you say, and the characters they end up in a situation where they are watching both of the Rodan monsters be killed, and they don't enjoy it. They seem distressed by the whole thing. And there's obviously like something in that about, like, you know, killing creatures, but it's not as at the forefront of the movie as the Godzilla being, you know, an allegory is in those films.
Yeah, that's why I wish they touched on it with the global warming thing, and then I think that could still carry on being Rodan's thing, you know, in the same way atop, you know, nuclear is Godzilla's thing. Yeah, but hey-ho, probably never going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, they were happy to do the Rodan sort of cameo in King of the Monsters, but I don't know that they're ever going to make title kaiju movies other than Kong and Godzilla in the modern era.
I don't think they will either. Like, I think at a stretch, you might get another Mothra one in Japan. And maybe that would be it. Or maybe a TV show out of push. But yeah, it feels like now it's boiled down to, you know, these are the main characters. Everyone else is tertiary kind of thing. Okay, the characters. Who do we have in this? I only really mentioned three here in my notes because there's really only three worth kind of talking about, I suppose. You had Shigeru Kawamura, played by Kenji Sahara. So that was in our last episode, Mothra vs. Godzilla. That was the Torahata, the cigar-smoking bad guy. Yeah, that's him. So he's a mining engineer. I quite liked his character. He was level-headed. You know, he's rational. He was quite caring. And I think his level-headedness kind of played into the, you know, it kind of lent credence to the idea of what he saw, you know, because he seemed so rational, level-headed, that him losing his memory for something so terrifying kind of adds to that, oh my God, what the hell did this guy see? You know, because he doesn't seem like a bullshitter.
Exactly, yeah, it felt like that had some credence to it. And you were like, well, when's his memory going to come back? Is it going to come back?
Yeah.
Sort of thing, yeah.
And it had some good foreshadowing as well, I think, when he looked at the eggs and that's when he got his memory back. But there were two eggs in that little nest.
Oh.
Yeah, I thought that was quite a nice little touch.
True.
But yeah, I only spotted that on my second time viewing.
I didn't think about that at all, but yeah, that, I think that maybe like a little clue.
Yeah, I think so. But yeah, I thought he was, you know, well acted, good character. I mean, not like it's particularly standout, but you know, perfectly fine for this movie. Perfect tone. And then you had Kyo, who was played by Yumi Shirakawa. I thought she was a good actor. This was her first film role. And apparently she's referred to as the Grace Kelly of Japan.
Did she marry some famous prince or something? Or?
I have no idea.
Yeah.
But, I mean, she basically cried in every scene. That was her job. Designated emotion person. I still liked her, though.
Well, I didn't dislike as much, but what I would do to improve it, perhaps, is just make her give her a bit more agency in proving her brother is not a murderer. You know, crying a lot about, you know, the deaths and stuff and their boyfriend losing his memory, that's all perfectly fine and of its time. But they could have just had a couple of little moments where she was a bit more forceful of us, like, my brother is not a murderer sort of thing.
Yeah, she's definitely a kind of pawn to say, like, oh, by the way, everyone else around her is horrible. They're all accusing Goro, you know, and you can tell everyone else is horrible because she's crying.
Yeah, and she just sort of is there crying, and her actual opinion about it is never really explained. Like, does she think her brother's capable of that?
Yeah, she doesn't really say it. The only person that does explain it is Shigeru. Yeah. He's like, well, Goro wouldn't do that, and she's like, are you sure? Well, she doesn't say that, but, you know, it's kind of...
She could say that, though, couldn't she? That's the thing, is like, they could have, like, we were like, everybody's blaming you for your brother's murder. Well, I don't think he is a murderer, and she's like, well, actually, I don't know if he's innocent or not. And, you know, it could be interesting, like, yeah, they could have done a bit more with that. But again, that's the age thing, isn't it? So she's a very good actress from what we saw. The movie's lacking a bit of humour as well. Like, a lot of the scenes, not that you need humour in every single movie, but there's no moment where, like, it just sort of relaxes between Shigeru and her. It's all very emotional. And there's no moment of just, like, breaking that tension a little bit at any point in the movie. So it's very sort of highly strung.
Weirdly, I liked that. I really enjoyed that. Like, you're right, there was no comedy. I suppose I thought it was going to be a bit more humorous at the beginning, like when Yoshi and Goro were fighting. And like, just as they're about to stop, one of the other like flicked the other one's shirt and something came off it. I was like, oh, that was a pretty funny fight. and then like there was no laughs after that point, not a single laugh. But I liked that, even though it was... I wouldn't even say it was dour. I think it was emotional and quite heartfelt. And that, weirdly, you know me and how I hate forced romances and all that kind of crap.
Yeah.
All of that I thought worked really, really well. So like the only thing that I thought was a bit confusing was that was Shigeru and Kyo's relationship, because I thought, you know, well, she's the brother of Goro, he's Goro's friend, and they kind of came together through his death kind of thing. And that's how I interpreted it on my first watch. I was like, oh, that's, you know, I thought that was really sweet. Like when they were being evacuated and Kyo went to go see Shigeru, I was like, oh, she, you know, she didn't bother going with everyone else. She went to go see him. And that, the way that music played there, I thought was really, really sweet. And I was like, oh, this is nice to see this kind of like subtle romance kind of blooming. But then after that, I was looking up the wiki page just to make sure I got all my ducks in a row kind of thing. And it said that they were engaged to be wed. I was like, really? Like, I didn't pick up on that. Apparently, I missed the subtleties of engaged people. Like, they did not seem engaged to me at all. I mean, this could be a cultural thing. Probably that's what it is. But in any case, I did like what I was seeing on screen. But I would never have pegged them as a engaged to be wed couple.
I got that they were a couple when Shigeru turned up at her house and I guess...
Oh, held her hand kind of thing.
Yeah, it was, oh, well, they're actually a couple. And the prior scenes that where they're talking, I'm just assuming this goes back to what we've cited many times, that public display of affection in Japan is kind of not a thing, I guess, especially in the 1950s and all that. So I think it's just that their relationship is subtle. And like you said, it's just through culture.
Yeah.
And maybe there is some things that are just a little bit lost in translation there where you just sort of pick up on it. I definitely thought, oh, they're boyfriend and girlfriend. I didn't realize they were actually engaged, but it doesn't really play a huge part of the story other than that, like, they are sort of connected. Like when he loses his memory, they bring her to try and like jog his mind a bit, and it doesn't work. And so they're sort of using their romance in that way. But otherwise, like, it's not a forced romance, is it? It's not really like impeding or imposing itself on the film to kind of like tick a box. It just sort of is there, and the subtlety of it, like, is beneficial in that regard.
Absolutely, yeah. I think anything that is there, it does add to what's going on, adds to some of the drama and some of the emotion. I wonder if it's because, like, I'm skeptical that they were engaged, to be honest, because at no point throughout the Japanese subbed version is there any mention of them even being a couple, let alone engaged. There's literally no mention of it.
Does she have like a ring on her finger or something? Like,
not that I saw. Maybe she did, actually. I didn't. So maybe take this with a pinch of salt, but there was no mention of it. But in the American cut / dub, they make it clear, like, yes, we're together.
So they might have just like pushed it along, and then it's just been,
and yeah, now through assumed, osmosis, yeah. It's like, yeah, okay, they were obviously a fiance, engaged to be married. So yeah, I don't think they necessarily were, but yeah, I mean, they were a couple, obviously. So whether they're engaged or not, I mean, it's whatever. But yeah, I like them. I thought they were lovely characters. Yeah, it hit all the right marks for me. And there was another character, Dr. Kashiwagi, who's played by Akihiko Hirata. So he's a paleontologist who's there to explain everything that we're seeing. Yeah, he's fine.
He's an exposition machine.
Exposition machine, yeah,
and
exactly.
The acting is actually quite good. When actors get roles like this, it must be quite difficult. Like, all you've got to do is, you know, you're holding, it's the scaffolding of the story, and you just get to describe things like, you know, jargon about kaijus and stuff. It's not very meaty acting stuff to do, but they do a good job making it feel earnest and believable, so it's cool.
Yeah. And that was kind of it, really. I mean, there are others, but none of those really made that much of an impact on the story.
It's like a good example of when a film, like, it doesn't have any human villain. There's no, like, businessman trying to mess things up or anything like that. It's just all about the monsters and the people who are affected by those monsters, which is really the perfect, you know, line to walk when it comes to the human drama of the kaiju movie.
Absolutely. The perfect balance of everything there for me. I found that final scene of the dying Rodans really, like, I found that quite moving. Like, I thought that was so sad. And the music they were playing there was very emotive. You know, I love to indulge in a bit of melancholy. So this kind of hit the mark for me. And like I was saying, it's Ifukube did the soundtrack. And obviously when you think of him, you think of, like, you know, big lumbering, booming brass and stuff like that. But I think he showed his hand at something a bit more delicate and heartfelt. And I like the parallels in tone between those moments between Kyo and Shigeru, and that final scene with the Rodan trying to save the other one, they had that similar kind of tone to the music there, which felt intentional. It might not have been, but I heard some parallels there, which I thought were quite nice. And you also got some ominous, you know, spooky music as well, especially when they're like preparing the missiles and stuff like that, you know. So I think he was showing his strengths on all fronts there throughout this. There's some similarities between some of the Godzilla music and this, but I mean, I think that's inherent with this style of music, really.
Yeah, I felt the melancholy and the death scene at the end as well. I think I probably would have been more emotionally affected if the effects were a little bit better, because they are sort of like a bit sort of, you know, it's just props sort of being dropped down to catch fire and all of that. So if it looked a little bit more impressive, I might have been more affected by it, because it's kind of obvious, like, oh, these are just like, you know, the special effects are a little bit aged there. But as an idea, it is very kind of unpleasant and sort of, yeah, it's unpleasant to look at, I suppose.
Yeah.
And you feel like, well, these creatures are sort of being killed off. And much like, you know, Godzilla and a lot of other Godzilla movies, it's like, is the creature deserving of this? Like, not really.
Yeah.
But they have to get rid of it.
Yeah. I think I was all in on this film. Like, I'm finding it hard to pick faults. Like, even with these special effects, like, the, for example, the city destruction scene was the best bit of the movie.
Those miniatures were very strong, especially compared to the previous movie we've just watched.
Yeah, unbelievably good. My partner was watching a bit of it with me before she went out, and she was like, "Oh wow, these miniatures are great!" Like, just, you know, it was just that good. And like, you can see people running around. I don't know how they did it, to be honest. They could see people running around inside the miniatures. There's probably some sort of composition there. I don't know how they did it.
Maybe they're just like rear screen projection.
Could
like
be that actually.
Is in there actually being projected in real time or something like that. It could, be compositing either.
I couldn't quite tell. I watched it a couple of times. I was like, how did they actually do that? I don't know. So it could be any number of those things. I don't know.
For the era, it feels likely that it's a live projection. But possibly compositing. Don't know.
Not sure. But really good.
They do a bit of compositing during the cockpit shots where the pilots are flying around near
Rodan. And a bit where Rodan, where you see inside one of the buildings when Rodan hits it, I think.
Yeah, so it definitely could be either or.
Yeah, yeah. So I think special effects wise, bloody good. I thought they were great. I thought they were convincing, even though there was some parts that were not convincing at all, like the piano strings holding up Rodan. it seemed to me like there was absolutely no effort to conceal that whatsoever, but it didn't matter.
It bothered you so much?
Not even a little bit. I was like, yeah, so like I did not care. And like, there were even shots when the planes were flying across and you see the camera pan across and you see the corner of the room, like the seam, the paneling of the room, and then it pans back like, oops, wasn't supposed to get that. And even with that kind of stuff, I was like, yeah, whatever. It didn't matter, because I felt so invested in this the whole way through. Like, none of that mattered. So like, that ending scene with the two Rodans, it kind of looks a bit ropey. It's like puppets flapping about, but man, I was all in. And I think Rodan's sense of scale actually was probably the best we've seen in any of these suit moments. Because I think it's in part to his design, because he looks less like a guy in a suit. So your sense of scale isn't influenced by that comparison. So you can kind of suspend your disbelief and be like, well, what is this thing? It's huge. Look at those buildings. They're small. This thing must be massive, you know?
When Rodan first hatches from the egg and it eats some of the Meganulon, the scale is
a bit out of
absolutely
whack.
Incredible. Like, it's like this baby Rodan is like so big in concept of like the Meganulon, like these tiny little maggots that he's eating. And the Meganulon is about the size of like three or four people.
Yeah.
And then later in the movie, when we see the fully grown Rodan attacking the city, it's like, it's not really that big.
It's not that big.
So it's sort of up and down a little bit. Is.
And especially actually at that scene where you see the egg hatching, you can see Shigeru near the egg and he's like maybe half the size of the egg.
I can't really tell. Is he supposed to be like looking
like far away?
Yeah, like how close is he supposed to be? So I just sort of accepted, like, well, he's sort of far away from it, I guess. But
yeah.
It's sort of the scale fluctuates from scene to scene. Because then I guess if you compare the planes flying alongside Rodan, Rodan would be smaller still than even he is in the city, I think.
Mm, yeah, true.
So I got a query about the Rodans, though.
Okay.
Because we get the UFO sort of reports about the Rodan. It's almost like we see those happening in the story.
Yep.
Then we get at a certain point a flashback from Shigeru getting his memory back that shows the Rodan hatching, mm-hmm. and then it's revealed that there are actually two Rodans. Mm-hmm. So the one that hatches is not the one from the UFO reports. That one was already flying around, or have I got that mixed up, or maybe doesn't matter.
The one that hatched is the one that was flying around.
Right.
Well, I mean, it could be either. Yeah, because the flashback
really
was,
I guess.
Because when that cave-in happened, Rodan hadn't been flying around at that point.
Mm.
And it was just after the cave-in, that's when Rodan started flying around. So
okay.
Rodan had hatched, but I guess grew up pretty quickly. But yeah, it could have been the other one.
Is it supposed to be that there's two because, like, the mother is coming to get the egg? Is that sort of story? Or is it just like, oh, there's two and we don't really know where the other one came from?
I think it's two, we don't know where the other one came from. Because the way I rationalized it in my head was there were two eggs in that cave, but because of his memory, he only really remembers seeing one. Yeah, and because when they went to go back and see the egg site, it all caved in and crushed all the egg, and they only found one bit of shell.
Yeah,
so you couldn't really tell. So that's how I... Yeah, played it in my head. Or the egg was just on the other side of the mountain or something. I don't know. But yeah, they did kind of, like I said, there was the foreshadowing with the two eggs in the nest. But then there was also, I don't know if it's foreshadowing or just pointing out that there is more than one, but in those news broadcasts, when it cuts to one of the countries, I can't remember which one, they're saying like, oh, well, we've had an attack in Manila and then another one in Beijing, like only 20 minutes apart. This is impossible. There must be two. And I was like, I thought that was implying that Rodan's so fast.
I thought so as well. Yeah.
So maybe that's what they were doing, saying like, oh, you know, you're just getting a sense of his speed. But then it ends up being two. So maybe...
It's up to you to decide the logic of that.
Yeah. I guess it's not that important. But again, I think it's part of the mystery, really. You know, of what the fuck's going on.
Feels like they may have invented a reason for there to be two so they could have an ending that felt like, oh, one tries to save the other and...
Yeah, probably.
Know. But yeah, it's fine.
Yeah.
It's a nice sort of surprise because, like you say, the Meganulon not being the threat is spoiled by the advertising of the movie because we know it's called Rodan and Rodan's on the posters.
Yes.
But there's only one Rodan.
Yeah.
So maybe they thought, oh, we can like sort of... You know, have a little surprise there by having two or something like that, you know.
Because it was a surprise, I'll be honest.
Yeah.
I was surprised. So when the second one turned up, I was like, oh, here we go.
Almost fell out of my chair.
Yeah. So yeah, there was a US cut of this.
Oh yeah, go
on. I realized actually in our last recording that I was going to talk about Mothra versus the Thing, but I never actually did.
No.
I'm not going to talk about it now. I mean, whatever, really.
I got the impression there was not much to say.
There are a couple of things to say, but it's not important at all, so forget it. But so I won't dwell on this too long. But yeah, there's another version, so the US version. It's 10 minutes shorter.
Oh, yeah.
But the biggest difference is the unrelenting voiceover, like in Gigantis.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so it's George Takei again.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so this was actually his first acting role.
Oh,
yeah, and then after that he did Godzilla Raids again.
The same thing again.
The exact same thing. So he's like voicing pretty much all the roles. And yeah, it's like an audiobook. It's just, it's constant. It's almost unwatchable in my opinion.
Is it like you see Rodan burning and he's like, I am seeing Rodan burning.
Yep.
Right.
Every thought is explained. Everything that's happening is explained. It's I found it difficult to watch actually. I'd say that's the biggest difference. They also use some like stock footage in the intro of like the real hydrogen bomb tests, which I thought was quite good actually. It was
I guess you could play around like, should we do it, be doing that, but like
Well, you know, I like
they've done it so many times, haven't they? It's like, okay.
I felt like the message that was coming across in the American cut was like, oh yeah, we did a bad thing, by the way. So I like that aspect. Yeah. And there were also a lot of stock music that replaced the score.
Is that maybe because I just had to replace so much of the sound? They just had to...
That was my assumption, but whether that's true or not, I don't know. That could be it. I mean, it seems logical, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I don't know. It wasn't as good. It sounds very westernized. I sound like such a weeb, I know, but like it just wasn't as good. Yeah, it didn't really fit the movie.
We have said, though, that King Kong versus Godzilla is much better than the American.
Yes, yeah.
So, you know, it just depends. It's totally case by case. And in most cases, they're not better because they remove things that don't need to be removed, or they treat you a bit more stupid.
Yes.
I think they're assuming, in the American sense, that you're going to like a matinee screening of like probably two or three movies and you're not really paying attention. You're chatting to your friends, you're having a snog with your girlfriend.
Yep.
You know, you're in and out to the toilet, and they put the voiceover there because they know like this is not a movie they're expecting to make much money on, because nobody's really going specifically to see it as much as they would maybe an American movie in an American cinema. Mm. But it's overbearing, it becomes very irritating, and you know,
it does, yeah.
Speaking of the sound, though, the thing that I didn't like in the Japanese version is when it's much like in what's the Godzilla Raids Again, where they're trying to bury him in the ice.
Oh my. Okay,
and
I know what you're going to say.
The ice in you know, Godzilla Raids Again, aka Gigantus, right? They're shooting the ice, and this explosion sound is like bang, bang, bang. The same identical explosion sound is heard over and over and
what
over.
What I really liked about it was how when they wanted to play back to back, it's like that cuts off the previous one. So it's obviously one sound effect track, and it's like, well, we've only got this one, so we want to layer this up, but we can't layer it, so we're just going to cut off the before it's even finished playing the full sound. We'll play the next one, and it's the same sound again.
Exactly. And then you get into Rodan and they have to like blow up the volcano at the end, and they play firstly what is the same sound effect over and over and over, and they're also like filming the same explosion from like three or four different angles, so you're seeing like sometimes the same explosion from like a marginally different angle, like 10 degrees to the left or the right. It's not even like
with Rodan's face poking out every now and then going back.
Yeah, and the same bang, bang, bang. And I wouldn't be surprised. I almost went back to check and then I didn't. But like, is it the same explosion sound effect as we heard ad nauseum in the other movie? Because I wouldn't be surprised if it was. Why would you reuse it so much in one film and then come to another movie and you're like, oh, we've got a different one now. It's like, no, I bet they just got one really decent, to be fair, explosion sound effect, and they're just like, well, we'll just use that over and over and over. And the budget is such that like they haven't got another explosion. Or I mean, I guess like back in this era, would they have to actually explode something to get the sound? I don't know. I guess so.
Like if you're filming like what is it? They blow up the sides of cliffs and stuff at quarries to like stuff like that. I guess you just take a dictaphone or whatever across, record it, and that's your sound effect.
That was the component that was missing. And you would think that after Godzilla Raids Again, they would be like, next time we do a big explosion sequence, we need a few more explosion sounds. Because it also goes on a long time at the end.
So yeah. this was my only criticism of the film was that final scene that you're talking about where they're blowing up the side of the mountain forever. It goes on.
Of how many times we hear the same sound.
You're going to look forward to my quiz.
Oh, I got to guess.
It goes on and on, and it feels really longer when they're using that same sound over and over. And like that was the last time I watched it.
Did you fast forward
before recording this? I turned it off. I turned off the film. I was like, I know what happens now. So
okay,
it just goes on for so long. It's way too long.
Yeah, it is.
I didn't see how long
like
it was
four
for.
Four or five explosions, and that would be enough.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it's more like, I mean, I'll guess later,
You'll
but
guess
it's
later.
A lot more than five or six.
Yeah. And I don't know how long it went on for, but it was long. I didn't actually time it. Who knows?
Probably went on for almost as long as we've complained about it for.
Probably. this is completely unrelated to kind of anything we've been talking about, but did you notice... the couple that were taking like wedding pictures
on the volcano.
All the charm of a quarry, really. Why are you taking pictures there? for a start.
Yes, that's like, a good point, actually. I didn't think of that. Like, why is this such a sought-after location?
Utterly surreal.
And also, when the woman was screaming because she saw Rodan, very weak scream there.
Yeah, not a scream queen.
I know we say, like, we want women to get more to do in these movies, but if you are there and your only job is to scream, like, give us a good belt.
Yeah.
It's a real, like, like, come on, like, scream a bit. It's very strange. It's really not, you know, not in the moment sort of scream.
Yeah. But yeah, on my last watch, there was something I noticed. So I thought, like, they died, you know, because the shockwave from Rodan killed them.
They get sort of, I guess they hit the ground so hard they die, sort of thing.
I thought that was quite a harrowing death.
Mm.
And then I thought the authorities found the bodies. And they were like, oh, trying to figure out what happened to them. But they didn't find the bodies. Did you know where did you see where they ended up?
No, I don't remember. I mean, they said, oh, the camera and the shoe were not near them.
Yes.
It was a point of contention.
Yeah, so basically...
Because they were saying, oh, is it a suicide pact? Was one of the theories right in the movie.
Yep.
So it wasn't, obviously.
Basically, all they found was a shoe. That was it.
Oh, okay.
Because their remains were in Rodan's den, where it's holed up. So, like, because you see a shot, it lasts maybe a second, if that. Like, you see some bones, and you see one of the shoes right next to the bones, and then it cuts as soon as you see the shoe. So, yeah, Rodan ate them, basically.
Which... The injuries at the start are quite gory as well, when the miners are first getting pulled out of the flooded mine, and they're all, like, bloodied up. They're pretty, they're much more graphic than I'm used to from the other kaiju movies when it comes to injuries. People usually just, like, get a bit of really sort of tomato ketchup-y kind of blood on them.
Yeah.
But in this one, it's much more kind of realistic. And I guess they want you to wonder, like, what has done this?
Yeah. And like the pilot's helmet covered in blood as well. And when they find that, and when the jeeps crash and stuff, you see like ragdoll bodies flying about, and quite brutal. I think that's going back to the volcano thing with the couple. I think they assumed it was suicide because I can't remember when it was. I think the early 1900s, there was a woman in Japan that committed suicide by jumping into a volcano. So I think that was why they assumed that's what happened. Because it seems like such a bold assumption to be like, oh, well, you know, probably suicide. But then why would one shoe be separate? It seems weird to jump to that conclusion of suicide. But I think that might be why. Going back to the US version quickly.
Mm.
So there's only really one other thing to mention. It's like, yeah, they made the romance more overt and tacky. You know,
standard.
Standard, exactly. But it made me think how there's never been any kind of UK or Europe release of Rodan ever.
Mm.
Not in theatres, not in like a DVD, a VHS, Blu-ray, nothing.
Wow.
Absolutely nothing. And it just seems annoying. I was going to say, it just seems crazy, but no, it's just annoying. I find that so frustrating. I really, really irks me when we don't get this stuff in the UK, and I don't know why.
You think we'd have like a Blu-ray of it by now?
Or a DVD or something. Yeah. Like, unless you import it and have a region-free player, you're not going to see this.
Mm.
You know, it's just, frustrating. It's frustrating. So if anyone's listening that has any influence on this, please do something about it because it's so annoying.
We got Mothra, so it's stand to reason. I mean, I guess Mothra's more marketable than Rodan.
I guess so, yeah. I think the time has passed for Rodan, I guess. You know, it's not that big of a character, like what you're saying, you know.
No.
You've got your main characters, and Rodan's not really one of them.
Mm.
So, yeah, that's my thoughts on that. So, did you have a favourite moment of this movie?
Favourite bit? I did really like the part where the Naganulon first came into the house, and it was like, what I liked about it was that I was cautiously aware that we might spend a long time sort of not seeing anything, or, you know, they would drag out the would-be murder mystery without really doing much. And, you know, there are other things they could have done, you know, but I liked that we got right to it. We're like, oh no, here's the creature. It basically clears Goro's name and, you know, We can move past that aspersion. So I liked that because it was an exciting scene and it meant the movie was like moving forward. And I liked that. I liked the bit where they also chased the Meganulon up the mountain.
Yeah.
Near the mining, you know, facility. And the thing that I liked actually most of all in the whole movie, and I really appreciated this, was that so much of it was filmed on real locations out in like Japanese countryside, yes, or Japanese places, not on sets. And I didn't really realize this when we talked about Mothra versus Godzilla, but that was majoratively, like huge amounts of it were just filmed indoors on sets and things.
I think all of it was, even the outdoor shots when they were outside in like the wooded area where they saw the Shobujin. I think that was a set as well, because you see like a miniature building.
Yeah, there's a bit where they're like, I don't know about the when they saw the big egg. Was it like on an actual beach or in a set? I don't really know.
Oh, I think that was a beach, yeah. But
this is the thing, it's like, yeah, there's so much of Rodan though where it's like they are in, you can see real hills, real mountains, real backdrops, and everybody's like, oh, this is nice. Like, it gave the movie like a very sort of tangible, sort of authentic quality to
yes,
it. And yeah, the effects are a little bit ropey, even compared to Mothra and Godzilla. They're not quite at the same standard.
Mm.
But that kind of realism and the choice to film on real locations gave it a nice sense of like reality that was otherwise missing from other elements of the film. So it sort of made up for it.
Yeah.
So it wasn't a moment as such, but that was the thing that I was like, I really appreciate this.
Yeah.
They've gone to the effort.
That's a good point, actually. Yeah. Because there was a shot I noticed when Shigeru first met up with Kyo after they found Yoshi. And it was just a shot outside. And the way the camera is angled, you can see the sky behind them. And I really liked how, I think they just had a fill light on the actors so that they were exposed correctly with the sky. And you got a whole, it was like, yeah, they're outdoors on a sunny day. And it felt, yeah, like you say, tangible. It was like, they're actually there. And it was such a different feeling to the other movies where they're almost never outside on location.
Yeah. And I mean, there are a few sets in Rodan where it like cuts to like a newsroom where it's a newspaper group, you know, newspaper journalists.
Mm-hmm.
And the set is very reminiscent of the sets that we've seen in Mothra and Mothra versus Godzilla. And you have to imagine that by the time they get to those later movies, this being the earlier one, that they are just sort of like reusing bits and pieces of those things. And that's why it looks similar.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a moment of me being like, oh, like, that could literally be the same bit of plywood with a window put in it that I've seen numerous times before. But majoritively, when they're outdoors, they're really, really outdoors, and the indoor sets are a bit more sort of robust as well.
Yeah, even like when they're in the town at night when, Yoshi's wife, Atami, she was like going to go yell at
the
Kyo.
Door and
yeah,
all of that.
I think that was a set, but it was... It was really well done. It looked like an old town, and it was quite large.
Yeah, I didn't second guess it as a real street.
Mm.
I mean, it probably wouldn't have been. I don't know. It's very nice sort of production values on this.
Totally agree. Absolutely.
What about your favorite moments?
The city destruction scene.
Oh yeah.
It was just maybe that's quite an easy, obvious one, but it was so good. And like I say, I managed to suspend my disbelief seeing this guy flying around on piano string because I was so, you know, blown away by it. It was so good, and the destruction was just unrelenting, and just seeing everything being blown to pieces,
rolling around and
everything just like absolutely on point. That's what you want in a city destruction scene. Really enjoyed it.
It's nice when you get one and you also sort of care about the narrative, and this is what we kind of complained about in the previous movies, that there was a lot of action, but it does sort of just take place in kind of like a bit of a wasteland sort of countryside area for Godzilla and Mothra to fight in.
Yeah.
Whereas with Rodan, it's not a versus fight scene, but the destruction itself feels like it's, you know, an important part of the story, and it looks really, really good.
Yeah. Yeah.
So just a couple of little subtleties in the sort of the story really help those scenes feel a bit more than like a guy in a suit, you know, smashing up a cardboard box.
Yeah.
It makes all the difference.
Yeah, it really does. It also included my least favorite moment, was an advertising for this drink called Kalpis, which sounds like Kalpis.
I think I might have spotted that.
Yeah, it's like a...
Put it out of my mind.
It's a caricature of a black person drinking.
Yes, I did see it.
Yes.
And it crossed my mind.
Yeah, I was just like, oh, you had this amazing scene, and that popped up. I was just a bit like, I think it's because you also see an Asahi beer sign, and Asahi owns that drink as well, Kalpis.
so, got to pay for this movie.
Yeah, so I think it was like a sponsoring kind of thing, product placement. Mm. But I looked it up. I was like, surely they don't still use that logo.
They do.
No, they don't. So in, in 1990, they dropped it because there was a complaint from this 12-year-old Japanese kid who was part of the Association to Stop Racism.
Oh, yeah.
And they were like, this isn't on, stop. So they dropped it.
Fair enough.
Yeah, so that's good. So, you know, there's a good outcome for this. But
Rodan
yeah.
destroys the sign, you see.
No, actually, no. Movie. The tanks do.
Well, they destroy it.
It gets destroyed. Yes, so. We're happy. Yeah.
Eventually, we'll get to an era of movies where we don't have to have any of that. We'll crawl our way out of Showa era.
I
know. Like,
I feel like each film, I'm like waiting for something offensive to happen. I'm like, oh, God, what's it going to be this time?
It's just a fleeting reminder of, you know, the social issues of the era the movie's from.
Yeah,
it's,
yeah.
So, yeah, there you go. It's unfortunate. It's not quite the painted face thing.
Yeah, thank God. Okay, right. Quiz time.
Oh.
So, 5 questions for you this time.
Okay. So, I have to... you took me getting 2 out of 4.
Yeah, exactly. So, I want you to get 2 out of 5 this time.
Okay.
Okay, so, question 1. What is Rodan's actual name in the original Japanese 1956 release? Is it A, Rodan, B, Radan, or C, Radon?
Well, Radon?
Yes, correct.
Okay.
I didn't think you'd get that. What made
you say
that?
Just guessing out of those. Well, the Don part of it being at the end of the word feels to me like that probably, you know, is relating to the lizard element of things, and like they've used Don in other creature names, so I think that must refer to like a dinosaur or something.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, that is exactly it, because it's a contraction of Pteranodon.
So why did they change it around for the West with Rodan?
Because when you look at it spelled, it's spelled the same as the word radon, which is a radioactive gas which is emitted from the Earth. So he'd be like, oh, why is there a movie about gas? That's why.
I guess so. I don't know.
That is 100% why. Because
that it's why, but yeah. I just don't care that they... I think that's today. They should have just like not cared about that.
I suppose, but I mean, it's stuck even in Japan, so he's called Rodan. Oh, I said it wrong. He's called Rodan now, so... I like the name. I like the name Rodan, so...
It just sounds like it's kind of like almost humanistic, the Rodan part of it. It's like, but yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, fair enough. So yeah, congrats, got that one. Okay, now, question 2. How many times do we hear the exact same explosion sound during the volcano missile attack scene?
I so wish I had counted. I was going multiple choice.
Oh yeah, it's multiple choice, but actually I want to hear your guess before I give you the choices anyway.
Okay. I'm going to say it's about... I don't want to overestimate, because it could probably be less than I think, even though it sounds like loads and loads and loads. So I'm going to say 28. Is this like stupidly low or...?
This is low. Okay.
Oh dear.
So is it A, 56, B, 67, or C, 78?
It's probably 78.
It's 67.
Right.
But...
In my brain, I was like, oh, it's probably about 35. And I was like, no, probably more like 25. So I sort of evened it out a little bit.
There's one of the explosions is very slightly obscured by the sound of a Jeep going by. So it might be 66. So,
well, I didn't get it right either way.
But in any case, yeah. So. For anyone who did sit there and count, I just want to, you know, just put that out there in case they argue with me.
It feels like 78.
Oh, absolutely. Well, the thing is, there are actually more instances of that sound used in the
just
film.
Just not in that.
Just not in that scene. So I think the actual total count is 70. Around about there. So yeah, it's we're in the 70s anyway. So
okay.
Yes. Okay, and I'm going to play that sound now for everyone to listen to.
Wait, a couple of times.
Yeah, 67 times. Okay, question 3. What is Rodan's wingspan in this movie? Is it A, 270 feet, B, 553 feet, or C, 871 feet?
I'm not good at this kind of thing. I'm going to say the 501.
Incorrect. It was 270 feet in this movie.
But in some scenes, it's bigger.
Well, yeah, when you look at the Meganulon, this was clearly way bigger. So yeah, this is the smallest incarnation of Rodan, and the 871 feet is the size of the MonsterVerse Rodan.
Oh, yeah. He's a lot bigger than that.
A lot bigger.
What a great scene.
Yeah, really good. That scene is so good, yeah. It's a shame there wasn't more. Oh well. Okay, so, question four. When do we hear this music?
I think I know.
Okay.
I think I know it.
Yeah. Okay, so is it A, during the news broadcast segments across Asia?
Mm-hmm.
B, when the JASDF squadron chase Rodan? Or C, when we see the second Rodan?
I believe it's B, because when the Japanese self-defense force, whatever they're called, come on, I felt like, this music's okay, but it's not the theme, you know, the one.
Oh, because that's, you're correct, that is the one. Yes, so yes, well done, correct. But isn't this basically Rodan's theme now?
But I mean, it's not the... Because the theme that we now associate with Godzilla...
Is the military.
Exactly.
March.
So that's what I was missing. I was like, oh yeah, this is where they'd normally play that music. And I sort of felt the absence of it. So that's what I mean.
So yeah, correct. Well done.
I'm up to two, I think.
You are up to two, yes. So let's see if we can get past two with the final question. Question five. How much did the Rodan suit weigh? Was it 100 pounds, 125 pounds, or 150 pounds?
Quite light by the sounds of things, and all of these measurements, I just thought it'd be really heavy.
That's heavy. Guess, they're all heavy.
I guess it is when you put it on.
Yeah.
I'll say 125.
Incorrect. It's 150. So that's like over 10 stone.
Yeah, I just... Yeah, heavy.
Heavy. Very heavy. So how did you do? You got... Two out of five.
Yeah.
Always two.
Never mind.
Never mind. No, good job. I'm proud of you. Okay. So, overall, I loved this movie.
Yeah, I can tell.
Yeah, man. Absolutely loved it. Like I said, yeah, I like the way the plot builds and how everything gets progressively more dramatic. I think it has some of the best visual effects, also coupled with some of the worst, but like, yeah, like I said, it didn't matter. It didn't affect anything I was seeing. Yeah, the characters weren't stellar, but, you know, they moved everything along and they weren't intrusive or weighing down the plot, so... That's a thumbs up there. Mm. Like, if anything, you kind of touched on a bit. It's like we could have actually built on some of that a bit more, some of their, you know, the dynamics between them. But then you run the risk of, you know, outstaying its welcome or it just being about those people. So I think it struck the right balance there. Yeah, some of the more emotional parts really landed with me, like between Kyo and Shigeru, and then the final scene, Rodan, with the really excellent music. Just the only thing is I wish that volcano missile scene was shorter. I think if that was shorter, this would be basically perfect to me. Like
is that why the American one's 10 minutes shorter?
No, it's still a really long scene. In fact, I think it might be longer because they double up some of the shots of Rodan poking its head out the cave and mirror it to make it look like it's two Rodans. I don't know. It still felt like it went on forever. So that's not why it's shorter. They just lifted out other bits for pacing, but yeah, this is one of my favorite films that we've seen. I love this film. I really do. Great film. What about you?
I don't think I loved it quite as much as you, but I would say it's probably the equal of Mothra in terms of like the overall quality of the film. Story is really good. You know, tethers you along nicely. You get some nice reveals. There's more than one creature. They put some effort into this, like, you know, the initial potential murder plot where, like, oh, is somebody, you know, taking the opportunity to use the cave-in as a cover for murder is interesting. And then it, you know, as that reveals to be a monster thing, it's like you could picture that story just being its own movie. And I like when that sort of thing, you know, sort of real sort of conundrums coincide with the monster stuff. So it feels like a very sort of grounded film, despite the effects being a bit wonky. It does feel a bit dated, as I talked about before. But yeah, it holds up and it's worth a watch. It's a good one.
Yeah. And it's not too long as well, which is also nice. I like a short film. Okay, so Kaiju Corner. Graham, what is this segment of the show?
This is where we talk about Godzilla and all kaiju sort of cultural footprints outside of the kaiju movies that we talk about. So it's a sort of extracurricular. What other things have been going on with kaijus over the last 70 years?
So we've each brought one to the table today. Both sort of related in a way. So one that I saw recently. So Alex Rushdie, the director of Dawn of the Monsters, which we've talked about on previous episodes and I've spoken to him as well. He retweeted out a commercial for OPG, which is the Ontario Power Generation Company. He retweeted out this commercial. It's like 15 seconds long. And it's about how nuclear power has been vilified by pop culture.
Mm-hmm.
So it's only 15 seconds long, but in the opening portion of the commercial, there's a scene with a totally not Godzilla kaiju terrorizing this city. I mean, it couldn't look more like Godzilla if it tried, frankly. So I wouldn't be surprised if Toho pipe up and say, by the way, stop that, to be honest.
Yeah, because Godzilla's not public domain the way King Kong is.
No.
And like, it's not an authorized use then. It's not a collaboration of any kind.
No, it's not, because
it really looks like it could be.
It really does. I think because the way his body lights up looks different enough,
and it's not the same
scream
either, is it?
Yeah. exactly. So yeah, this kaiju that's obviously Godzilla is terrorizing the city, and it's all about how it's time to flip the script of nuclear energy as a safe energy source. Just to be clear, Alex wasn't tweeting this out in support. He was just like, what on earth is this kind of thing, you know. So yeah, basically it's spin for nuclear energy. Now, what doesn't sit right with me with this is, even taking into account nuclear energy's benefits and safety measures and stuff like that, what the ad does is it diminishes real life events by pretending it's only pop culture that's given nuclear energy a bad rap.
That's correct.
And yes. So it's like, what about Chernobyl? What about Three Mile Island? What about Fukushima? Like, these weren't pop culture events. These were catastrophes of the highest magnitude. So, like, to paint it like Godzilla walking around destroying a city is giving nuclear energy a bad rap is disingenuous, to say the least. And
because who really goes to Godzilla movies these days thinking about nuclear power plants anyway?
Yeah, exactly. It's absurd. It's absurd. I find it pretty appalling that an energy company of all is playing the victim. Like, it's pretty disgusting, to be honest.
Multiple reasons.
Yeah.
Not limited to any potential criticism of nuclear energy itself, which I don't know about you, like, I'm kind of indifferent towards nuclear energy as a thing.
I'm the same. Sorry, go on.
No, just that, you know, there are other reasons, like, that I wouldn't be weeping for an energy company other than, you know, the actual source of the energy itself. I mean,
yeah.
Nuclear energy has its, you know, like I say, its famous disasters, but there's also obviously countless nuclear plants out there which are just doing fine.
Yeah.
That's a separate kind of argument. But to harness the allegorical kind of nuclear bomb creature for that is really kind of gross and short-sighted. Like, I
completely.
Yeah.
It's slimy.
Especially when you consider that Shin Godzilla is very much sort of the re-inspiration from the Fukushima disaster. And it's like,
exactly.
Yeah, really kind of gross. And I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of lawyers were talking about it. It's not even an energy company that you've really heard of.
Yeah, it's a government-owned company in, well, Ontario, in Canada. So it's like, I'm the same as you. I'm not necessarily for or against nuclear energy because I don't know enough about it. I don't know about its waste management and its safety. Like, yeah, there's tons operating without issue, but you know, there were some that weren't. So I think it's okay to be skeptical about it, but to act hard done by, especially when it's a bunch of fat cats probably sitting on a pile of money whinging, go fuck yourself, honestly.
Yeah,
I found that just appalling. It was really bad.
Godzilla movies are not the reason people don't like nuclear power at any cost, any rate, you know.
No,
it's fucking stupid.
It's ridiculous. Like, maybe it's fair to reevaluate nuclear, but just to act like it's movies that's given it a poor image is bad form.
Yeah,
and it just, yeah, like you say, with like Shin Godzilla, you know, it just ignores the fact that it was inspired by real life events.
I doubt they've even bothered to research it that deeply, yeah, just to even realize like that connection exists, and like artistically this is insulting because of what Godzilla means as a character.
And what's weird was in that commercial, like the only two things that are in it, one was Godzilla and the other one was just a guy in a hoodie. And like, it's like, wait, what's that a reference to? Like, is slim pickings for people criticizing nuclear power in pop culture. Like, yes, it happens, but not as often as they're acting like it is.
Well, maybe so. The Canadian government thinks it's okay to infringe on Japanese IP, but not like, you know, the Incredible Hulk, where they might actually worry about Disney really coming after them. They maybe not have, you know, credited Toho with enough sort of, you know,
yeah,
legal energy to do something about it, but I'm sure if they want to, they will.
Yeah. And to act like Godzilla was the result of a nuclear power plant blowing up is also bollocks. Like, it was an atom bomb, you know. What the fuck? I don't know. I don't know what they're going at with this. And it seems like it's okay to open up a discussion about it, but to act hard done by, nah. Not cool.
Well, if you want to have a serious new discussion about nuclear energy, you need to do it in a way that's a bit more intelligent than that.
Completely.
And just going after like these sort of like, you know, this somewhat satirical sort of like, oh, we're going to make fun of this a little bit so we can address it. It's just like, it's not very funny.
It's not funny. Yeah, it wasn't funny at all.
So
yeah, it's
for a few reasons.
Swing and a miss there from OPG. Mm. So that's me at my soapbox about that. Yeah, I haven't got anything more to say about it, but if you get on YouTube or wherever, just type in OPG Godzilla commercial, you'll see it somewhere listed in articles.
Yeah. Assuming it's still going to be used, I wouldn't be surprised if they pulled it if there was a legal problem.
It really does step on Godzilla's toes. There's so much that, like, there's no mistaking, because I when I saw it, I thought, oh, this, they've actually used Godzilla. It looks that much like him.
That's so. What I thought. I mean, we can't really presume that Toho wouldn't be up for this, because we don't know. But what we can say is that there's a, at the very least, even without any cultural or social issues, you know, notwithstanding, that they are infringing on copyright pretty heavily here. Yeah. So the whole thing is just really crappy and lame.
Yep, completely. So yeah, that's mine. Now I'm nice and heated about that. What's yours?
Well, the theme today with Kaiju Corner would be Godzilla in advertising, I suppose, which there are probably like many, many examples of this that we will revisit in the future. But probably, at least in my opinion, I don't know about you, because I guess maybe you've not heard of this even, but the most famous use of Godzilla in advertising in an official capacity is the 1992 Nike shoe commercial, Godzilla versus Charles Barkley.
Right. Tell me.
Yeah.
What's happening?
It's a good ad. Well, it's a good ad. I mean, there's not really like any sort of mythos to the creation of this commercial as such, but, you know, Nike were making a shoe deal with Charles Barkley and they wanted to do an ad. And I guess because they wanted to show like how big their star was, they thought, oh, well, it would be fun to just do this with Godzilla. It's just like an idea. For people who aren't aware, Charles Barkley was the star player for the Phoenix Suns back in the 90s. And they never won a championship like a lot of teams in the 90s because of Chicago Bulls related reasons. But people will know Charles Barkley, whether they're into basketball or not, if they've seen Space Jam, because he is, other than Michael Jordan, he's the primary athlete who acts in the film. So Charles Barkley is pretty famous, and he still works as a sports pundit now. He's a known kind of guy. So they had this idea for Nike to do this ad with Godzilla, and Toho sanctioned it, said, yeah, you can do that. And all these special effects were done by ILM. So they made the Godzilla suit, and they used their sort of puppet technology, similar to like how you do with like the Gremlins and stuff. So all of the eyes and the mouth are sort of controlled by servos, so it actually blinks and sort of expresses a little bit, as well as having like a guy in there, I think.
And who are ILM?
ILM is the That's Industrial Light and Magic, which is a very famous special effects house in America. And they made their name on Star Wars. And then they've done like loads and loads of movies, you know, like Terminator and Jurassic Park. That's ILM.
Yeah.
So if you've been watching any 90s movies like that, this is right in that era of like the peak of their powers. And the city that they used to stage this like quick 30-second basketball showdown between Charles Barkley and Godzilla was the same set they used for Ghostbusters 2, which has a sequence which is its own kaiju corner, you might say, where the Statue of Liberty becomes like somewhat sentient and is controlled by the Ghostbusters walking around New York City. That's like, that's a Godzilla thing, right?
Yeah.
So they took those miniatures from that sequence. I've never actually seen Ghostbusters 2 all the way through, you know.
Haven't you? Have you seen that scene?
I've got a bit of osmosis about that.
I was going to say, did you recognise the sets or anything, or the miniatures?
I didn't until I read the facts, because they've made it look like Tokyo. They put, like, you know, Japanese signs and things up.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the ad is pretty straightforward. It's very, very short. You know, Charles Barkley happens upon Godzilla smashing up Tokyo, but Charles Barkley is, for whatever reason, the same scale as Godzilla. So they have a basketball showdown. Charles Barkley wins because he's got the shoes. The Nike shoes, which are, today I was trying to find the name of the shoes. What particular shoe
is it? Does it not say in the ad?
I don't think so.
Oh my God.
You just watched it, so.
Yeah, I did. But you know me, like, I can't take it in the first time around.
It doesn't, though. It's not like, it's obviously like not an Air Jordan.
Let's see.
There must be like some.
There's a shot of like the side of the shoe. And like, you know, what I know about shoes, you could fit on a grain of rice. It could be any shoe. You could tell me anything. I'll be like, yeah, that must be that shoe.
Well, the shoe is itself Charles Barkley affiliated. It's his shoe. But as far as I can tell, it's not called like the Barkley or anything, which is easy to Google. So I've looked up like Charles Barkley Nike, and I've looked at all these photographs of Charles Barkley and the Nikes that he wore at that era. But I don't know. I don't know what the shoe is.
I guess it was just Nike advertising
in general.
Just
general Nike. I guess that means they can just play it like at nauseam, like as much as they want.
Yeah, true. You could play it today.
Yes, you probably could. Why not?
Yeah.
Barkley beats Godzilla, and at the end he says, to console Godzilla, he says, the Lakers are looking for a big man, which might be alluding to the fact that Magic Johnson had recently retired and left the Lakers, and I guess they would be looking for a guy. It might be a joke about that.
Sports jokes.
In the Japanese version, where the NBA, I guess, was not as popular in Japan at the time, he says to Godzilla, have you ever thought about wearing shoes? So it's a different joke, because they
have
might
you ever
sure
thought about wearing shoes?
That's what he says.
Yeah, maybe that one would land better with me, because I know nothing about sports. So,
well, I guess it's for a sports fan. All the information I'm getting for this is on Wikipedia if people want to look at it in more detail. But yeah, it's just a nice ad.
It's nicer
than the one that you talked about. It's very funny. The effects are like literally cinema movie quality, because they've got a real effects studio to do it. They've got the big name. Charles Barkley was in a lot of commercials back then. Like I say, he's done a tiny bit of acting.
It's good.
It's good.
Can't imagine how much that cost to make. I imagine a lot of money.
If you assume that Charles Barkley's fee was probably tied into the shoe deal, they probably didn't pay him specifically for the ad, but the effects alone probably cost about $10 million.
Yeah. It's a good ad. I like it.
Ah, there's an extra bit.
There's an extra bit?
Yes, there's even more to this kaiju corner that I forgot to add.
Here we go.
The ad was so popular that they adapted the advert into a full-length one-off Dark Horse comic book called Godzilla versus Charles Barkley. I have not actually found it anywhere where you can buy a reissue. I've seen it on eBay for some money.
Right.
But this panels from that comic have become sort of memeified. Mm. And I sent you one today where it's like Godzilla's like slam dunking.
And he's wearing the shoes.
Exactly. He's wearing like Nike branded shoes. So it says Godzilla got busy, which is a sportsman's colloquialism for Godzilla put in some practice time. And so it had some legs, you know, this whole like thing. And it goes way back to the unproduced movie, like Godzilla versus Frankenstein, right? Like, this was always fun to see Godzilla versus something absurd.
Yeah.
And I think it must have directly inspired, because we're getting into more, you know, advertising basketball stuff now, but there was a Michael Jordan versus Bugs Bunny commercial that came a few years later, and that's where they got the idea to do Space Jam from.
Oh, right.
So I'm sure if they hadn't made Godzilla versus Charles Barkley, they wouldn't be a Space Jam. And it's a shame that Godzilla was, at this point in 92, there had never been an American produced Godzilla movie, but really, like, who knows? Like, in another era.
I mean, in the 80s, there'd been an American recut with some new scenes for Return in 84, I think it
was. Something like Godzilla 98 sort of thing.
Yeah.
This is before all that, but maybe in another time we would have got Godzilla versus Charles Barkley, the full length feature instead of, or as well as Space Jam. You know,
imagine that.
But yeah, it's a fun commercial. It's fun to imagine. Maybe, I mean, if they did a full length movie, it'd probably suck. I have no idea what the comic book is like, and if we ever get our hands on it, I mean, it's probably available somewhere online. You know, variously, you can probably read it. But that could probably be a exciting little mini discussion.
I'll see.
We love the Godzilla comic books.
I'll see if I can find it. That's cool. I wonder if I don't know when we spoke on the last one, we spoke about the Simon Says sample being used in basketball. Like, which came first? Was the use of that in basketball first, or did this commercial come around first? Because I'm wondering if they're like, oh well, you know, Godzilla and basketball, they're now like a thing. Let's use this Godzilla tune. You know, is there some parallel there?
I'm just quickly googling. Isn't Simon Says like a somewhat recent song?
No.
Ah, okay. The Simon Says song by Pharaoh Monk came out in 99.
Yeah.
So the song may have been inspired by the commercial, maybe?
I don't think the song as such, but as in, like, its use within basketball.
Yeah, they might have, like, been like, oh, yeah, I don't know, maybe.
Mm.
Maybe. There's just osmosis, perhaps. But, yeah, there's a sort of a through line there, sort of been created in the early 90s. Yeah, you're right, obviously the song would not have been inspired by the shoe commercial to then be played at a basketball game, that's right, but... yeah, maybe there's something that links it all together.
There's a weird link between basketball and Godzilla. Your two faves.
I'll try not to have another basketball related kaiju corner next time.
Yeah, I'm done with the sports talk now.
Yeah, if it happens, I don't control culture. You know, culture is what it is.
No, it's fine. It's fine. You just have to explain it to me because I obviously have no clue. Yeah, that's a cool one. I really like that ad. Yeah, much better than mine. I'm going to see if I can find something a bit chirpier for the next one. Okay, so how do people speak to us, Graham, if they want to talk to us?
Go on social media and search for Monster Island Radio on wherever you want to talk to us. Anywhere's fine. We'll pick up the phone. Not literally, but, you know, figuratively speaking, the phone will be answered. And we welcome all feedback and opinions. We want to know how your thoughts on this movie differ from our own, whether we made any little, you know, mistakes. We can, you know, submit corrections, obviously. Or if you just think it's such a great podcast, you want to let us know. We like to hear that as well.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I think if you search Monster Island Radio, or Monster Island, it's going to come up on Instagram, Facebook. Have we got Facebook now?
No
just
Facebook.
Have a look. You have a look and you tell us if we're on Facebook or not. I don't know. Monster Island Radio, that's what you want to do. Search for it.
Yes, and you will find us. Perfect. Yeah. Okay, cool. So I guess until the next episode, bye-bye.
Bye.